Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora. Welcome to Bookends with Maureen Rout and Marianne Stone. Today I'm going to be talking with Wellington poet Kate Camp about her wonderful new collection of poetry. I'm also talking with Peter Cox about his biography of New Zealand journalist Douglas Brass, and with Derek Leask about his remarkable new book, The Atlas of the New Zealand Wars, Volume 1. A mighty book, a weighty tome, a taonga and a thing of beauty, the Atlas of the New Zealand Wars is all this. It is, of course, only Volume 1, and its author spent 30 years researching the book. Derek Leask served in New Zealand's Foreign Ministry from 1969 to 2012. He was ambassador to the European Union in Brussels, Deputy Secretary at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Wellington, and New Zealand's High Commissioner to the United Kingdom and Ambassador to Ireland. So in the midst of this extremely busy and prestigious job, Derek, you found the time and the interest to research maps. Where did this come from?
Well, thank you, Maureen. Yes, I found that indeed I wanted to do that. It was almost a necessity, I decided, in 1990 or thereabouts, in the context of our sesquicentenary, our 150-year commemoration or celebration of the Treaty of Waitangi. I decided I needed to know more about my own family's parts in New Zealand's early history. And indeed, as a diplomat, I decided that I really needed to understand much better the turbulence of New Zealand's 19th century. So I started researching at that point, found family connections into the wars, and that really led me into the whole business of finding out more about what happened between the 1840s and the 1880s.
So what do maps tell us that written reports don't?
They show clearly, sometimes, clearly where people went, or at least where they thought they had been, and they allow you to understand more clearly the connection between one place and the next and the difficulties or the impediments that exist in getting there, or indeed the dangers of attack or other problems as they moved about the country. Moving about New Zealand was, for the British, a tricky process. They often didn't really know where they were going, and of course they had no control or no knowledge of the interior of the country. So at least at the outset, the coast was known territory, the interior was not, and they needed to understand what they were doing.
You make it quite clear from the beginning that these are European, British maps on the whole, that, you know, there weren't actual maps that Māori kept. But there are three instances in this first volume of maps that Māori made.
Yes, that's right. The Māori did not themselves produce great numbers of maps. They knew their way around. And the two or three maps that we have that were drawn by Māori were actually done mainly at the request of British people with whom they were friendly. And so they were a bit unusual for that reason.
Yes, they would be sketches, really not meticulously topographically detailed maps.
Well, yes, but they provided essential and essential information, or at least gave an idea about the shape of a defence. There's one, for example, of early one of Ruapekapeka, and it gave a sense of the magnitude of the defences at Ruapekapeka.
You have said, I think you've said it, because a lot of people have said some remarkable things about this book, but I think you've said yourself that you've ended up writing a new history of the New Zealand Wars.
Yes. It wasn't plain to me when I started this exercise that I was writing a history at all. In fact, I wasn't even at the outset writing a book at all. I started by just recognising that in British institutions in particular, there were huge numbers of valuable maps that weren't available in any form in New Zealand. And I thought that at least researchers needed to have reliable information about the holdings of British institutions. And so for many years, I was simply preparing a catalogue of the maps. But then I talked to Sam Elworthy at Auckland University Press, and he was impressed with the catalogue, and he told me, I think there might be a book lurking in there, and asked if I could write. I said I thought I could. He said, you better go away and prove it. and so I gave to him a couple of chapters of a possible book. And as we looked at that, we realised that actually if you put the maps together with a clear and comprehensive context, you did come up with a new history of the wars, because the maps, when you associate that with what's now digitally available, all of the old references, if you put all of those things together, you provide a slightly different factual framework for the wars, something which has got more certainty about it, which defines more clearly the paths through the wars and the dates and the people and who was where, and so that you can provide a new history which simply provides more clarity about what actually happened when.
Yes, I think you're right about that. I remember when I was reading Vincent O'Malley's big work, seminal work, I was really interested in how clear it was from the correspondence that he could, I mean, it had been available before, but, you know, the intention of the British when they got here and how they carried out their intention was, to me, irrefutable, really, about what their aim was, what the end of the initiation of a lot of the wars or parts of the wars were. And that seemed to me to be really, really important for us all to understand.
Yes, well, there was a big clash or conflict of objectives in the British system. The one was a sense that Indigenous people needed to be able to live properly and to be treated fairly. And on the other hand, you had what you might call the colonial imperative, at least of looking after British citizens who were British people who were living in other parts of the world. And those two objectives were entirely inconsistent, not entirely, but were broadly inconsistent in the New Zealand case.
Yes.
And they wrestled with that throughout.
Yes, because you say, you know, Pākehā leaders are seen from time, you know, time after time, putting investor and settler interests ahead of Māori property rights.
Yes, and sometimes it was blind, sometimes I think it was deliberate, but that is something which I don't explore in great detail in the book. I do point it out, but my main objective is to tell a clear, easy-to-read story of what happened.
The maps themselves, you say you started off really with the intention of cataloguing them. Did your position, your being a diplomat and your being on the spot overseas, did that get you access to places that other people might have had difficulty getting into?
In the main, no. Most of these are public institutions, and they are very good about it, about access on the whole. The problem for New Zealanders in getting access is mainly that it costs you a fortune to get there, and you've then got to have find accommodation, and you're under time pressures, and in the end, many of the institutions are for that reason simply inaccessible. But the, yes, there were occasions where I think it's fair to say I was treated very nicely because of my position. And that was particularly the case in the French institutions, where I was given wonderful access, for example, to the material in the hydrographic office in Brest, in Brittany. And the admiral there was pleased to help the ambassador.
Yes. Well, I can imagine for a lot of these people who work in these institutions, the archivists, the historians and whoever's there, it must be really, really good to know that somebody wants to see these old documents. It must be a joy to them that somebody has come seeking them out.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that one very good example of that is a wax model that I found in the Liverpool, in the World Museum in Liverpool, where this is a model of Ruapekapeka, which was made in 1846, probably by one of the crew or the officers of the North Star. And that had a long history. It was held for a time in London and then ultimately was held, was transferred to the World Museum in Liverpool because their collection was depleted, badly depleted by the destruction of the Second World War. So they got it. And now, of course, it was in their basement. But they were thrilled that I had found a reference to this plan and then found the plan. And so they took it out and I don't think they're going to show it, but they're pleased to have some life put back into this piece of wax that was lying in the basement there in Liverpool.
Yes, I can imagine that would be the case. Derek, I don't want to detract from the content of this book, but I think it's worth towards, you know, to end talking about the actual production of the book because it is the most magnificent book. It's a joy to look at. It's been beautifully designed. It just pays great tribute to all the work that you have put into collecting and writing about these maps.
Yes, well, I was thrilled that Auckland University Press wanted to devote some real resources to this. And I think, Warren, that the key decision that was taken by AUP was that they were ready to put the money into paying for the production and then the rights to all of these plans held overseas. These things have to be made available to New Zealanders. And they're in all of these institutions offshore, and they were prepared to pay for the digitisation of of a large number of these plans. And boy, that, those institutions charge.
I bet they do.
Yes. So they just put enormous resources into this book, and it is just so evident in the production of it. It's nice quality.
It's beautiful quality, and even if you're, you know, only remotely interested in the wars, the whole conduct of them and where they went to and how they did it, just looking at the maps and seeing the variety of, you know, other illustrations that you've collected, there's, you know, paintings, there's prints, there's, you know, an extraordinary, you know, there's the actual plans of the barracks and the and the houses.
Yes.
You know, everything combines to give you such a remarkable picture of the time and the age.
Yes, and Auckland University Press also agreed with my approach, which was that this could be a book which would be useful to dip into. You can look at the Auckland bit or the Wellington and the Hutt bit or the piece about Akaroa, but also, they wanted a book which you can actually read from start to finish, because it's only 175 pages of text, even though it's a big book. And if you read those 175 pages, you can get a pretty good idea of, hey, what happened in these wars?
Yes, you can. And I have to say I'm looking forward to Volume 2 now, because having grown up in the Waikato, I am really interested in following that, you know, very closely.
Yeah, well, that was my starting point, because my great-great-grandfather provided the little steam vessels which supplied General Cameron up the Waipa River.
And such a... that is a tale to be told. Thank you, Derek, for all the huge amount of work and time you have put into cataloguing, researching, writing, and putting Volume 1 together. As I say, I'm really looking forward to Volume 2. So
thank you, Maureen. Yeah, I'm delighted to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The book is called Atlas of the New Zealand Wars, Volume 1. It's written by Derek Leask and published by Auckland University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Tunis is Mad Tonight is the intriguing title of a book about the life and times of New Zealand journalist Douglas Brass. It's been written by Peter Cox, who is a retired chartered accountant and company director, but he's also the author of two books, Good Luck to All the Lads, The Wartime Story of Brian Cox, 1939-43, and Desert War, The Battle of Sidi Rezegh. And Peter, you have an actual connection with Douglas Brass.
Yes, and I think this book would never have happened without it, because he was a great uncle of my wife, and it was when cleaning out her mother's house when she'd passed away that all this material came to light, and it was just a real revelation. I had met the fellow many years ago, and I knew a bit about his background, but not the depth and breadth or quality of the work that he did.
The beauty, I suppose, is that because he was a journalist, so much of his writing, almost all of his writing, has probably been preserved.
Yes, that's the big benefit of it. But interestingly, I don't think this could have been done 20 years ago, or certainly not without living in Melbourne for a long time, by being able to access the Australian Library Archives.
Exactly. But I guess it's the personal side of his life that you need to balance out.
That's right.
The writing.
And that's where we were lucky in having quite a lot of correspondence, not voluminous, but at least gave you a real sense of the man and what was behind the newspaper articles. I think that was really important.
Well, tell me, or tell us, because I know, because I've read the book, yes. But tell us about his early life. He grew up
He grew up down south, yes. He was born in Invercargill, educated initially at Southland Boys High School, but then he had a year at Waitaki Boys, and I think that was a very influential period for him because of the network of friends that he developed there and the quality of the teaching. He was there just at the right time in the sixth form under the rector, Frank Milner, with all these other people like Charles Brash and Ian Milner. Very influential, I think. But unfortunately, the family ran into hard times through the Depression. He only had the year there, and then he was taken back home because they couldn't afford to keep him there. And his uncle, who was the chairman of the Southland Times, got him a job as a reporter in Bluff.
He did go to university up in Canterbury, didn't he?
Yes, yeah. It was very fortunate that obviously a quite astute editor said, you need to take this up as a career. And so he came up to Christchurch and did a master's here for 5 years. And again, meeting all these New Zealand emerging writers, and I'm sure that that had a significant impact on him personally, but also the way his style and career developed.
He would have met Dennis Glover when he was here in Christchurch.
Yes, they became quite close friends, actually, which continued throughout their life. And so, again, fortunately, these things like the Charles Brash journals, the Dennis Glover letters, and the biographies of these men helped fill out some gaps that we didn't know about. But the Glover one particularly was an interesting one.
Well, exactly, because Douglas comes across as quite a sober, very reasonable man, and yes. We know that Dennis Glover was often...
exuberant.
Yes, the absolute...
Yes.
So when it comes to life, I suppose, it's interesting seeing the evolution of his work and his going to, what led him to Australia.
Yes.
But then when he became the war correspondent,
yes.
That's when he really came to notice, didn't
yes.
he?
Yes, I think he was very fortunate to come under Sir Keith Murdoch, who obviously took a very close interest. The two wives had a very close personal connection, and I think there was a really paternal relationship. Anyhow, Murdoch dragged him out of the artillery, the Australian artillery, and sent him off to the Middle East to be a war correspondent, unquestionably launched his career because he happened to be in the right place in the right times on the day when Tunis is mad tonight.
Yes, wonderful title.
The relief of Tunis. and his reports of that liberation, front page of the London papers, And that continued. It wasn't just a once-er, but that really launched his career, and beyond London too, overseas into the States and other countries.
And the war correspondents were, there was all this thing about them being embedded. Mm. I remember back in one of the Gulf Wars, the journalists being embedded with the troops. But he was... really close to the action,
a lot of his colleagues were either wounded or killed. They were ducking and diving with the troops. And, in fact, they ended up in Tunis, arrived in Tunis before the Eighth Army did. So, and they had the Germans surrendering to them. They certainly saw a lot of the action. Personally.
And it was through people like Douglas Brass that we know what it felt like and what... was going on around him in these really pivotal moments.
Yes, they faced quite challenging constraints, particularly around censorship, and that early part of war was really tight. It tend to loosen up a little bit after the Americans came in, but no matter what they wrote, they knew that someone would be overseeing it and having another crack at it. But I think the what impressed me so much about Douglas Brass, he tells the story, but he paints the picture too. So you're getting a far more three-dimensional view of what was going on, particularly with the non-combatants, you know, the civilians and the people who war was passing through and over and around.
Yes, he was very perceptive, I think. And, you know, for me, having had a father in that sort of area of war, even though he was in the air, not
yes.
on the ground,
yes.
You know, that part of the book was really interesting
yes.
to me.
And it was for my wife and I too, because we had been there. We went through North Africa into Libya just before the Arab Spring period. So we travelled literally over some of the ground. We travelled through some of the minefields where they were scattered around like blue bottles on a beach. And so his comments about landmines, for example, really struck home. We knew exactly what he was talking about and could relate to how he reacted to it.
Post-war, he stayed on,
he
really.
He stayed on in London for about 10 or 15 years, actually, in various guises. But particularly that first period through to the early to mid-50s, where he was involved in reporting on the post-war reconstruction of Europe particularly, but also the establishment of the United Nations. I mean, what a time to be a reporter, you know, with a lively interest. His Master of Arts, first class honours in history. He had was well equipped to really get in touch with what was happening.
And he was mixing such an interesting group
That's
of people.
Right. Yes, both the politicians and the other correspondents around that. Just the whole environment that he worked in must have been very stimulating.
Oh, goodness me. And, you know, he kept his New Zealand contacts, didn't he?
Yes.
You know, with people like Brash and
yes.
Glover and
yes.
Ian
yes.
Milner.
Well,
and
a number of them, of course, were in London during the war. And it was interesting to be able to compare in some cases their different experiences to the same bombing attack. That was really interesting because James Courage was there also.
Yes, I was just going to pull his name out
yes.
because I read his diaries,
yes.
was it,
yes.
that have just
yes.
come out recently?
Yes.
Yeah, and get his perspective on being bombed
yes.
in London.
Yes, but again, it felt very personal because he and Brash, Courage and Brash, were living very close together. And within about half a mile, or kilometre now, of where my sister-in-law lives in London. So we know that area really well. And the route that they walked every day, and the underground station and the apartment, Brash, we knew all that. So it was a remarkable coincidence. But it certainly helped give colour to the people.
Yes, because Douglas Brash... Brash, I'm getting confused
yes,
now.
You're not the
Douglas
first.
Brass.
You're not the first one.
No. He, as we said, he was quite a reserved person in lots of ways.
Yes.
So, you know, kept himself to himself.
Yes.
He wrote his opinions quite openly, and he
yes.
was quite fearless
yes.
in that regard.
Yes, but even talking to the wider family, you know, the other nieces and nephews, you'd ask him, so what was he like? And they'd say, well, he was just Doug. You know,
yes.
he was really, and I felt that too, and the other one or two people that met him, really very reserved, but very much a man of his times. They didn't,
yes.
They didn't process a lot of stuff, you know, verbally. They just bottled it up, really. Mm.
But he, as I say, he wasn't afraid to speak his mind, if you like, or give his opinion.
No, well,
in his writing,
yes.
in his journalism,
and there were plenty of examples of that that came through, particularly about Vietnam. I think that in the latter part of his career, you felt you're saying, well, whatever, I'm just going to say what I think, and really going for it about Vietnam. The quality of the Labor government in 1975, I think it was, but even some of the things that were going on in New Zealand, particularly New Zealand's attitude towards the common market, he didn't hold back.
No, he was very critical of New Zealand
yes.
throughout.
Yeah.
He was loyal, but he was critical,
wasn't
he?
The thing that I was disappointed with was some of his criticisms about the New Zealand arts scene.
Yes.
And I totally get it.
Yeah.
But I felt that he knew a lot of these people, and through his continuing relationship with Glover particularly, you would have thought he might have taken a more charitable view of the transition that was happening in New Zealand at that time.
Mm. I agree. He was quite scathing about them without, you know, actually looking in more deeply to,
yes.
into
yeah.
what was going on.
Yes.
Well, I can imagine people like Brash and Glover would have been quite annoyed with
them,
wouldn't
they? Well, I hope they were. I hope they were, because I just felt it was a little bit disrespectful to them, actually. Mm. And I don't know what his motivation was. And he did a very early article about New Zealand, and he was only 27 years old at that stage when he went to Melbourne. And it was very disparaging and quite sweeping with some of the generalisations, but that was his style.
Well, exactly. And you're writing, you're not trying to, gild the lily here.
I tried to let his words tell the story, rather than me offer opinions about it. It was that arts thing. It's the only thing that got a little bit under my skin.
Mm. So, you know, if I ask you what surprised you about him, that would be one of the things that...
Yes, but I think also the breadth and depth of what he reported on, whether it was the Picasso exhibition in Paris, the London theatre scene, the book reviews, of which he did quite a lot, social... I mean, there's a lot of stuff which isn't in the book because there was just so many aspects to go down. A lot of internal Australian news and developments. Very wide. He must have had a very wide knowledge of current affairs and the arts, so it wasn't just one-dimensional.
Of course, one of the, you know, really interesting things in there, I mean, there's so many, but the fact that he was employed by, was a friend with, and knew so much about the Murdoch empire as it became.
Yes.
Sir Keith, and then his working with Rupert and his comments about him.
Yes.
That holds a huge amount of interest for readers.
It's fascinating, really, and I think that there was an interesting role reversal because I think when he joined the Murdoch Empire under Sir Keith was his mentor, clearly, and helped him with his career. Sir Keith died relatively young. At the time, Rupert was, I think, 21, and at Oxford, and the Brasses were looking, well, I wouldn't say they're looking after him, but they definitely took him under their wing, and there's a lovely letter from the Murdoch thanking them for their looking after Rupert. So then there was the role reversal where Rupert was really being mentored by Douglas Brass. I suspect that Rupert's mother had something to do with that because it was the family jewels that Rupert was taking over. But they had a very close relationship from about 1960 to 1975, which is quite a long time. And particularly that period when they were establishing the Australian newspaper, very close working relationship and mutual respect, clearly, though challenging at times, undoubtedly.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, so that in itself, as I say, is a really interesting component of the book. You must really enjoy researching, Peter.
Absolutely love it. And part of it that I felt I was lucky that a lot of his friends, the Brashes, Glovers, I knew a lot about them through a Caxton Press connection. And I think that I was very fortunate in having sort of close family links on both sides of that story because I wanted to put his story into a context. And I thought relating to what his friends were doing at the same time was probably one that I could speak about far more than his career in journalism, which really needs someone with a real journalistic background to deal with.
Are you hoping that this will encourage people to do a book of that nature?
Well, I think I would be really interested to know how he would be considered by the New Zealand journalists. He's not in the Australian Hall of Fame media. He's not in the New Zealand one. So where does he fit with his career and achievements? How does he rate? I don't know. It seems to me very highly, but I'm an amateur in that, making an assessment like that.
Well, I would consider him very highly from what I've read in your book.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And I think New Zealanders, even though he... was disparaging, as you say, about us.
Yeah,
I think we should, it's good to know about him, to put him into that context.
I think it's a really interesting story, actually, how he went from a reporter boy in Bluff to the very close relationship with the royal family, that we haven't talked about that, and the Queen personally thanking him for his work on the royal tour, travelling out on the boat with them.
I know.
It's a whole different, you know, there's a book in that in itself.
Exactly. Can you imagine them letting any of the press close to them?
I think they'd be rather selective.
Very selective. Well, congratulations on all the work that you've done. It's a highly readable book. It's a fascinating story, and I think, you know, even though he kept himself to himself, you've done a really good job of telling us about him and introducing us to his life and work.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure both doing the story and talking to you about it. I really appreciate it.
The book is called Tunis is Mad Tonight. It's the life and times of New Zealand journalist Douglas Brass. It's by Peter Cox, and it's published by Quentin Wilson Publishing.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Extra large geometry. I experience the ocean as a vertical plane. As I came down the road from the funeral, how it filled the space of the valley like a vessel, the dark blue cup of it against the mid-blue sky. And again today, from the window, across the rust-scarred landscape of the neighbour's roof, the sea's extraordinary flatness as if pasted on, and then the white rectangular shock of a ship at sea, what could be more obvious? Yet I retain the ability to be thrilled by them, as by the yellow yacht that wallowed in the slow-moving wake of the ferry, while two girls lowered their long white bodies to the water, gold-purple summer light just gone off the hills. Seasons, makeshift seasons.
That was Kate Camp, a Wellington poet, reading from her latest collection, Makeshift Seasons. Kate has won many awards for her writing, including the Catherine Mansfield Monton Fellowship in 2017 and the New Zealand Post Award for Poetry in 2011. Kate, I was anticipating that you'd read that poem, not just because the last line is the title of the book, but also because those lines, what could be more obvious when you've seen the ship at sea, yet I retain the ability to be thrilled by them. And that, it seems to me that that is in all your poems, the ability to be thrilled by something so obvious.
Yeah, I mean, I think something that poets nerd out on a lot is poets like to say, oh, you know, every poem is an ars poetica, every poem is a poem about how you write poetry. And I don't think that going into any poem, but I think that one probably is for me a little bit of a mission statement, you know, a little bit of a manifesto, unintentionally. And I had a funny conversation. One of the people who pops up in this book is a guy who's a painter in Wellington who I often meet walking our dogs down at Island Bay. And he said he came to the launch of the book, and he said he'd just done a painting that had the Inter-Islander Ferry in it as well. And he thought, oh, can I even include it? It's so corny. And I said, well, that's the advantage for us poets, is then we can say within the poem, you know, how obvious it is, and, you know, can the poem can contain our question mark about that. So, yeah, I think, you know, I'm obsessed with the ocean. Lots of people are. But it's one of those things that you feel almost self-conscious about writing about, because, you know, it's been such a theme of poetry for millennia. But yeah, if we can't take on the big things now, then who else, you know, who has more right than us to write about whatever we like?
Well, that's you, I think. You do write about whatever you like. The I seems so definitely you, and how you put down your version of the world, how it appears to you, what your place in the world is.
Yeah, and I think that sense of, you know, poets, you know, when you're you're an observer, and there's what you look out and see, but then there's also the eyes that do the seeing, and it's kind of that combination of those two things, isn't it, that makes a poem or poet distinctive. And I often think about that, you know, people talk about voice, and, you know, I've got various writing workshops that I've been in over the years, and people talk about voice, but I think that's something I don't think that you have a perception of as the writer. I think it emerges in your work, but it's not something I'm ever conscious of. I can recognise it in retrospect as a reader looking at my work, but I'm never aware of it as a writer.
So you're not tinkering about thinking, that doesn't sound like my voice?
No, and I almost have the opposite feeling of, you know, I think I often include things in poems that I think other people would cut out or eliminate or censor out, as thinking, oh no, that's a thought that the writer is having about the poem. It doesn't belong in the poem, or that's a sudden reversal, or if, you know, if the poem says I don't know, or, you know, blah, blah, blah as a placeholder, you know, or if the poem has a mistake in it. Like sometimes, you know, my husband has an amazing awareness of dates and facts, and he'll sometimes like to fact check something and say, but, you know, your mother can't have been 37 at that point in the poem. But I think, well, the poet's perception of her was that she was that age. So, yeah, I like to leave in a lot of the workings, I think, in a poem.
Yeah, and you don't embellish your poems too much. They're pretty straightforward, aren't they? There's not a lot of, you know, similes or whatever. I know you use metaphorical devices, but they're not obvious, really.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I feel like contemporary New Zealand poetry and, you know, recent New Zealand poetry, that plain spoken voice is such a part of our poetry, and not just in New Zealand. I mean, I think it's, I think it's very much, there's always exceptions, but I think that plain spokenness is there in that American poetry. You know, I'm reading an old anthology that I've had for ages, that's called Scanning the Century. It's poems of the 20th century. And, yeah, just the diction, the way that it goes through sort of decade by decade, and the way the diction changes and evolves. But even some of the older poetry that I love, like Robert Frost, you know, I learned After Apple Picking by Robert Frost off by heart a few years ago. Every now and again I like to learn a new poem off by heart. And I noticed the diction in that, and for its era, I don't know, it was like 1910s or something, it would have been radically plain spoken and naturalistic. I think that's a vein that I feel that I'm in.
It's interesting about you learning a poem every so often. I just realised the New Yorker had a thing going, well, don't know if you call it a thing. They encouraged people to read a particular poem and learn it by heart. And so that it was an exercise that they set their readers. I was tempted, but I was too slack. I didn't do it. But it seems like a really good thing to encourage people to do.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you understand a poem, you know, as a practitioner, I think that you understand a poem in a completely different way when you learn it by heart and you memorize it. And sometimes it's obvious that, you know, the poems are rhyming poems, or they have obvious things in them that you thought might make them easier to learn off by heart. But even ones that don't seem to have a lot of guide ropes, you know, along the way, once you're learning them off by heart, you really come to appreciate how they're constructed, and especially the sound and the rhythmic qualities of them. And that's so important to me. I mean, I don't write rhyming poetry, but the sound of poetry and the rhythm of it is absolutely essential. And I'm sitting at my writing desk now, and I've got all these different notes and exhortations to myself up there. And one of them I've had there for years is a quote from Christian Bock, who said, you know, focus on the sound and let the sense take care of itself. And I very much believe that.
That's why it's nice to actually hear the poet read the poem, because how you've perceived it or how you've read it on the page can change quite remarkably sometimes when you hear the poet read.
And I think especially for people who aren't really into poetry or don't, you know, have a big poetry component in their life, it's a lot easier to get to grips with it when you hear it read aloud.
How did you go about, well, not how did you go about, but where did this collection evolve from? Were you writing poems that all seemed to be following on one after the other, or was it a different
process? I'd like to say there's more of a scientific approach, but, I mean, essentially my approach to writing a book of poetry is finish one book of poetry, write some poems, and then at some point think, oh, I think there's enough here for a book. So that's the same with this. But it's not arranged chronologically in order of when I wrote them, but the first poem in the book is the, I think, one of the earliest poems that I wrote. And it's a poem, one of the few poems that I wrote during the COVID lockdown. So that was, you know, 5 years ago. I think so for me, that kind of brackets it in time, that I published a new and selected poems that came out in 2020. And so that had a, not a full book worth, but, you know, half a book's worth, say, of new poems. So yeah, these are poems of the last 5 years.
Yeah, so really what they're saying is this is what's taken my fancy or consumed me or whatever.
Yeah, this is where my head's been at. Yeah. And I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, obviously the ocean, the sea and swimming are quite a theme of the book, although they perhaps don't appear as often as you might think, but they do pop up regularly in the coastal locations. And that's because, you know, I learned to swim shortly after when the poems in this book start in 2021. But I also got a dog in late 2020, and so I'm just at the beach a lot more, walking the dog as well. So I'm spending a lot more time at the coast, and I now have a totally different perception. Having lived in Wellington my whole life and being a real hometown person, it's quite amazing, you know, in your 50s to get a completely different view of the place that you're from. And now I'm like, oh, the land is just like a secondary consideration to me. I'm all about the sea.
No. I think you get drawn to it more as you get older. You take it for granted in your early years, and then later on you see it as such a sustaining thing, such a... I live by it. I look at it. I swim in it, but not all through the year. I'm sorry to say, but it's such a part of my life. So I really resonate with poets who are writing about it that way. And also, there's your response to, dare I say it, the aging process, your body not doing what it used to do? Or
yeah, and I mean, I chose the, when we were talking about a quote from a poem to have on the back of the book, that, you know, the publisher had a few different suggestions, and in the end I said, well, what about this one? You know, the failings of the body can be a form of company, a trapped nerve ringing in the night like music. And I chose that specifically because, yes, I do think that the failings of the body are quite a feature of the book. But I also think, you know, I was talking to someone about the book recently, and they said, do you think you're writing more about the body now than you have in the past? And I said, I actually don't think I am. I just think that now that I'm older, it's perceived as writing about the body, whereas when I was younger, it was probably perceived as writing about sex. So, you know, and it wasn't necessarily about sex then, but like I remember one of my early poems is about pissing against the side of the bowl so that you can piss quietly when you're staying over at someone's house in the early stages of a relationship, you know. And I think that's probably classic me, in that I do like to include things in a poem that I notice, and then I think, oh, I couldn't put that in a poem. And that's always a sign that I should put that in a poem, you know. I think I'm not sure that I think my poems have always been very bodily embodied and had a lot of physicality in them, and a sort of unromantic and and sort of factual version of the body. I mean, I said in a poem years ago how I got up and I had a pillow in the bed because, you know, I must have had a sore back or something, and I was sleeping with a pillow under my knees. And when I looked back in the bed, it looked like I was still in bed and my body was still in there. And I said in the poem, my body, my dear old friend, as if I would ever abandon you, because I feel that sense of affection for my body and all of its quirks and failings and abilities and inabilities.
Well, our bodies, you know, we can be quite proud of what they can still do. It's not always failings.
Absolutely. And I think that's just part of that, that sort of democratic view of poetry that I have, that, you know, everything belongs in a poem, you know, be it the ocean or a tree or a smear test or, something. They're all happening.
They are. Yeah, it's part of what you come up against every day, and everything and anything's possible. Would you like to read us a poem just to finish, Kate? Whatever you think runs on from this or doesn't.
Yeah, well, I'll read this poem. This is an unusual poem within the book, I think, in that it's not autobiographical. It's a more imaginative poem. I think the title tells you everything you need to know. It's called Getting Your Period in the Middle Ages. If I have another sister, I will miss my wall. This stone I call my cat, and this its mouse. So we each have something of a pet. Others rise in the watch to piss or muck about, but I stay rolled in this warmth I've made, as a tree keeps warm in her bark by never moving. I build with my hands over my nose and mouth a little church where I do my breathing, the smell of all myself, vinegar and bacon, and make account of all my griefs today. How, when fetching water, I saw the kind of centipede I fear the most, marching as an army, then got caught to sing aloud, "Oh, black, the day you died," Edward laughing on the inward breath like a duck. I sleep again and dream two fumbling stories. In the first, I am before the fire, cold, but when I move towards the heat, a second dark hearth is in the way. In the next, I'm eating grapes, the smell of them, more dear than any flower, and my limbs grow heavy, useless. I'm lying under the globes of grapes, lying on my face, on my eyelids, a branch of eyes. My mother says my time has come upon me. It doesn't yet, though if it would, I should ask you to fry an egg for me, and with care take down the smaller spoon, tip the pan to ladle grease across the white that it will set. Though she would say the song to me, when swine be cunning in all points of music, and pigs be mad poets for their eloquence, then you'll have an egg for breakfast, miss.
Thank you, Kate. The book is called Makeshift Seasons. It's by Kate Camp, and it's published by Te Herenga Waka Press. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.